All righty, we're underway then with session 5, page 29 in your workbook. So let's take a quick review of where we were last week. Last week we looked at the principle of dispersion and regathering. We saw that this has happened many times in Jewish history. It began with Abraham's quick little sojourn into Egypt, just shortly after receiving the Abrahamic covenant. And this sojourn was limited to the land of Egypt, and for a short time. That was followed by the Egyptian slavery, which lasted quite a bit longer, 400 some years. But again, that was limited to Egypt, to a neighboring country. The more significant exile is the Babylonian exile that began in 605 BC and was finished up by 586. And by the time the Babylonian exile was over, there was very few Jewish people in the land, just a remnant. But we were regathered in 536, as recorded in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. But this exile had a larger scope. This one was now limited to the Middle East, not just to a neighboring country, Egypt, but now spread out all over the Middle East, all the way to Babylon. The next major exile is the Roman exile that started in AD 70 and was finished up by 135 AD. This one lasted quite a bit longer, 1900 years until around 1948. But again, the character of this regathering is very important because it also was worldwide in character. And worldwide dispersions are the key ones. One more dispersion awaits us. And this is the tribulation exile. This will occur in the midpoint of the tribulation and will last for a very short time. It will last only 3.5 years, but it will be very severe. And we will be regathered for blessing at the second coming from a worldwide dispersion again. So my point of going through this is to say that just because Israel is in the land and out of the land and back in the land and out of the land doesn't mean that we lose the title deed to the land. We've done it a number of times. We will do it one more time, but the title deed to the land still remains with the Jewish people. We talked a little bit about the coming Russian invasion. Remember, here's little tiny Israel down to the south there, and then to the north, the western edge of Russia, where Moscow is almost due north of Jerusalem. And Ezekiel 38 and 39 tells us that the coalition armies will come down from southern Russia through Georgia and through Turkey and probably through Syria, heading for Israel. Their object will be the mountains of Israel. The invading hordes will make it to the mountains of Israel. The mountains of Israel, of course, are the central spine of Israel, the Judean hills. And, of course, in the Judean hills is located Jerusalem, which appears to be the object of their attack. But what does God say? He says they will not succeed. He will destroy them on the mountains of Israel. So that's probably the next prophetic major prophetic event that we should anticipate is the Russian invasion of Israel. Then we talked about the two worldwide regatherings. The first one, in unbelief, the purpose is judgment to be experienced during the tribulation period. The second worldwide regathering, in faith, the purpose is blessing that will be experienced during the Messianic kingdom. So this is a key bit of information that I would say 99% of the Christian world either ignores or is ignorant of. Two worldwide regatherings. Remember, Isaiah 11 predicts two worldwide regatherings from the four corners of the earth. Yes?
Your first regathering, I thought that's what we're studying now.
Yes, we will be studying.
That's what is happening now.
Yes, that's what's happening now.
It says it's experienced during the tribulation.
Yes, the judgment that will come as a result of this first regathering.
Gotcha.
Will occur in the tribulation. Right, that's the purpose for regathering us all. We're not done yet. We're getting there. 50% of us are in the land now. All right, then I had some issues with Dr. MacArthur. First of all, I took issue with his statement that nothing specifically going on in Israel right now is connected to biblical prophecy. And I really must disagree with that position. I would say that Israel is in the center of biblical prophecy, that we are in the eye of the biblical and prophetic storm, the prophetic tornado, the prophetic hurricane. We're right in the middle of it. So I can't agree with him there, that nothing is biblically important. Secondly, he said that he didn't feel that God is going to protect Israel because he has some obligation. And I disagreed with that because I said that God has obligated himself to protect Israel on the basis of the unilateral Abrahamic and land covenants. Israel will not be protected because we deserve it or because of anything we do or don't do. It's because God will vindicate Israel due to his covenant-keeping nature. He will vindicate Israel, which was my point of bringing in Ezekiel 36. He talks about vindicating his holiness a few times. I will vindicate the holiness of my great name, he says. And as we get to the end of that section, he says, the nations will know that I am the Lord, declares the Lord God, when through you I vindicate my holiness before their eyes. So how is he going to vindicate himself? Is he going to destroy the Jewish people? No. Is he going to reject the Jewish people? No. Is he going to replace the Jewish people with the church? No. What does he say here? How am I going to vindicate myself? I will take you from the nations and gather you from all the countries and bring you into your own land. Now, when the Christian church reads that, they should stop and say, wait a second. Israel and the land means that God is proving that he exists. He is proving that he is a covenant-keeping God. He is proving that he's powerful. He can take these people, this tiny little nation, scatter them all over the world for 1,900 years, and then bring them back. A unique situation that's never occurred in the history of the world before. So he's vindicating himself. But unfortunately, the nations and most of the world don't care. You know, especially those that don't believe in God. And where does he say he will return us? Will he return us to China? South America? Japan? No, I will return you to your own land. The land I deeded to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the Abrahamic and land covenants. So the Jewish people in the land, we are not a perfect nation, but we do have every right to the land. We've been given it by God. Just a tiny little notch. You see it right there? Tiny little sliver of land on the eastern end of the Mediterranean. You see, God is not... doesn't have to be vindicated by the spectacular, does he? You know, those of us in this world, we think if we're going to vindicate ourselves, we've got to have fireworks. You know, we've got to have a big demonstration. We've got to have something big happen. A Super Bowl, I don't care, you know, whatever. God doesn't need that. He doesn't need that. He uses the small and the weak to vindicate himself. You know, God at his weakest was Yeshua on the cross, you know. He doesn't operate the way we do. Look at that tiny little nation. Let's back out. I mean, there's the world. There's plenty of bigger nations he could have vindicated himself through. There's China, and there's Russia, and there's Egypt, you know, in India, all kinds of big nations. Where's Israel? Can you see Israel there? Yeah, it's that little red dot right there, you know, little red dot. And, you know, this is God's apologetic. This is God's apologetic, you guys, because this is just a tiny little nation. Just to give you an idea, those of you who have been to Israel know how tiny it is. You know how you can walk the land. But just to give Californians an idea, the nation of Israel is 1/19th the size of California. 19 Israels can fit in our state. 19 Israels can fit in our state. And why is it a great apologetic? Well, because it proves God. And here's a story that I've heard three variations of. Three versions of this story. I'll share two of them with you here. The first one concerns Benjamin Disraeli, the Prime Minister of England, also a Messianic Jew, by the way. Once he was asked if he knew of any infallible proof of God's existence. His terse answer is classic. He said, "The Jew, sir, the Jew."
Okay. Did you say he was a Messianic Jew?
Yeah, he was a believer. Yeah, yeah. And another version of the same story is the Kaiser. There's a famous story in which the Kaiser, the German emperor, asked Bismarck, German politician, "Can you prove the existence of God?" Bismarck replies, "The Jews, Your Majesty, the Jews." And the third variation I've read is the Tsar, the Emperor of Russia. The Tsar asks a Russian politician, "Can you prove the existence of God?" And he says, "The Jews, Your Majesty, the Jews." Well, they're all reflecting the truth of Ezekiel 36. where God is going to vindicate himself by bringing us back to our own land. So it is an apologetic. So think, if anyone asks you, well, prove to me that God exists, just give him this answer. And then turn him to Ezekiel 36. Question?
Is it possible to get those quotes?
You want those quotes?
Yes.
Which version? Both versions?
Yes.
Okay. Remember, there's three. Don't forget the czar. I only have two. All right. Let's see. I'll call it the Israeli quotes. Quote, yeah. Yeah, the Jews. The Jew proves, yeah, okay. All right, let's move on. Yeah, Israeli was Jewish. Disraeli was...
How do you know that he's a believer? Does he say that publicly?
Yeah, he converted to the Christianity, yeah. He, quote, was a convert, yes. All right, then we looked at the characteristics of the final regathering, and we also looked at the blessings of the Mosaic Covenant, and that brings us now to page 29, bottom of the page, as we continue through the subject of the blessings of the covenant. And the reason I'm going through it is just to make it crystal clear that this is not the final regathering that we're experiencing today, because the blessings of the covenant are not what's predicted in the scripture, and we're also a nation in unbelief. Now, if you'd like to look at more material on this, I would suggest Dr. Fruchtenbaum's manuscript 132, the Messianic Bible Study 132, the blessings and cursings of the outworking of the Mosaic Covenant in Leviticus 26. Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28 both cover the blessings and cursings of the covenant. So this is a good manuscript to get. You could get it tonight. You could download it tonight if you're interested. All right, point B, page 29. Let's start with Leviticus 26, verses 1 and 2. Question. You had that chart for 2012. Yes, 2012 is when it occurred.
That's the year?
Yeah, that's when we became number one. Israel became the number one Jewish population center in the world, surpassing the United States. All right, we're looking at the blessings of the Mosaic Covenant in Leviticus. We start with the blessings in verses 1 and 2. And we see in verses 1 and 2 the principle that obedience is required to the Mosaic Covenant. Obedience to the Mosaic Covenant is required. You shall not make for yourself idols, nor shall you set up for yourselves an image or a sacred pillar, nor shall you place a figured stone in your land to bow down to it. For I am the Lord your God. You shall keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary. I am the Lord. Now, we're told not to worship idols, but guess what? Here's a picture that appeared in Biblical Archaeology Review just a few years back. And here these ladies are up on the Golan Heights, and they're dancing and singing before an idol. And there's the cute little idol right there. And here's the caption. I've edited it a little bit. Potter Daphne Zuckerman replicated a clay figurine, thought to be that of a goddess. For about half an hour they danced while the leader recited a prayer, thanking the goddess for the forces of life, fertility, and peace. Not the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Some goddess, you know? Well, guess what? Idol worship has returned to the land. I'm back! Idol worship is back. And you know, the principle holds true that if you break one part of the Mosaic law, you've broken it all. That's James 2, verses 10 and 11. Whoever keeps the whole law and yet stumbles on one point, he has become guilty of all. For he who said, do not commit adultery, also said, do not commit murder. Now, if you do not commit adultery, but you do commit murder, you've become a transgressor of the law. You see, the law, you guys, is like a chain. 613 links. 613 links long. You break one link and you've broken the chain. That's the concept. So, idol worship is back in the land. God requires obedience, and our characteristic is to be disobedient. It has not changed. Let's look at verses 3 and 4, where the conditional nature of blessing is emphasized, verses 3 and 4. If you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments so as to carry them out, then I shall give you rains in their season. Notice the emphasis on rains here. So that the land will yield its produce and the trees of the field will bear their fruit. Now, that is a very important blessing for Israel because rain is so tremendously important to that land, to that country. But you know, we haven't been experiencing lots of rain for many years. We haven't been experiencing this blessing. We've been experiencing drought rather than abundant rain. For example, in 2001, the Sea of Galilee sank to an extremely low level, endangering Israel's water supply. And it's still going on. For example, this is an article in the Jerusalem Post. They're predicting even more severe droughts. Water Authority, severe drought from 2015 to 2035. Israel must prepare for the possibility of a severe drought period that is expected to begin within a few years, the Water Authority warned on Monday. Models from the authority's hydrological services have predicted that Israel will face a long and difficult drought from 2015 to 2035. Well, that may or may not happen. We'll see what happens. But which will be even more exceptional than the country's previous two drought periods. This is the point I want to make. 2004 through 2010 and 1999 through 2002. So from 1999 to 2010, the land has been characterized by drought. And let me show you an example of that. I was in Tabqa in Israel in 2009 during one of these droughts. And here I am standing on the beach at Tabqa. What's wrong with this picture? Tabqa doesn't have a beach. Tabqa doesn't have a beach when the lake is full. This is the water level when the lake is full. That's the water level. Here's how Tabqa looks when the lake is full. Oh, see that? Question.
Did you know that R&D project in Israel has been approved?
R&D. Oh, the Red Sea to Dead Sea? Yeah, they're trying everything they can to get water and to make hydroelectrical power and everything. Yeah. So there's Tabqa, and there's where I was standing to take that picture. Wow. I should have a snorkel to take that picture. One more shot. Here I'm looking down the beach. Look at that, you guys. I'm standing right about here, right about there to take that picture. I should be totally underwater. But look how low the Sea of Galilee is. When it gets to the red line, the sea will get polluted and be destroyed. But we have been plagued with drought for many, many years. So this blessing of the Mosaic Covenant has not been experienced, especially in the last decade or so. All right, let's move on to verses 5 through 10. If we obey God, we'll experience prosperity, security, and peace. We're now on page 30, if you're following along. Verses 5 through 10. Indeed, because of this abundant rain, Your threshing will last for you until grape gathering, and grape gathering will last until sowing time. You will thus eat your food to the full and live securely in your land. I shall also grant peace in the land, so that you may lie down and no one making you tremble. I shall also eliminate harmful beasts from the land, and no sword will pass through your land. But you will chase your enemies, and they will fall before you by the sword. 5 of you will chase 100. 100 of you will chase 10,000, and your enemies will fall before you by the sword. So I will turn toward you and make you fruitful and multiply you. And I will confirm what? My covenant with you. You will eat the old supply and clear out the old because of the new. So many promises there. Many promises there, but one of the promises is security. Yeah. And you know, Israel is hardly secure these days. Instead, we're harassed within and without by our enemies. Now, in 2002, the mayor of Jerusalem made this statement. In Israel, The war is being fought not 5,000 miles, but 500 feet from the bedrooms of our children. And we do not feel we have to apologize for defending ourselves. Has it changed? This was the current, in 2002, the mayor of Jerusalem. I don't remember who that was. And it's still going on. Here's some recent articles from December of 2013, just a couple of months ago. Two more arrested in Jerusalem rock ambush. Police are holding seven Muslim youths from Tsur Bahair over an ambush in which a baby girl was wounded. Hebrew University, Mount Scopus campus is a war zone. Arabs of neighboring Isawiya are completely fearless in their attacks, say students. Arut Sheva has been reporting this crisis for what? For years. So it's still going on. So we're not experiencing the blessings of prosperity, security, and peace, not to the extent that God promises. Now, in verses 11 through 13, probably the greatest blessing of all, the blessing of God's presence. Let's look at verse 11 through 13. Moreover, I will make my dwelling among you, and my soul will not reject you. I will also walk among you and be your God, and you shall be my people. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt so that you would not be their slaves, and I broke the bars of your yoke and made you walk erect. So God's presence, great blessing, but God is not walking among Israel today. Yes, Steve.
So they're talking about after the millennial kingdom, basically.
Yes, that blessing won't be experienced until the millennial kingdom.
So is that a reference to Messiah?
Yes, yes, that'll be Yeshua. And also the Shekinah glory will have five manifestations during the Messianic kingdom as well. Yeah.
Is that permanent during the...
Yes, yes. That will not be withdrawn. So we're not experiencing this blessing of the covenant today. Rather, we are experiencing the curses of the covenant. And that brings us to point six in your outline, page 30. Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28 both cover the blessings and curses of the covenant. So let's go ahead and continue through Leviticus 26 and to see what the rest of the chapter has to say for us. So let's pick it up with now the curses of the Mosaic covenant. And we start in verses 14 through 17. If we disobey God, he will smite us, he will discipline us with sickness, harassment, and insecurity. But, big change here, big contrast, but if you do not obey me and do not carry out all these commandments, if instead you reject my statutes, and if your soul abhors my ordinances so as to not to carry out all my commandments, and so break my covenant, I in turn will do this to you. See, we didn't enter into this covenant with our eyes blindfolded. Okay? God didn't sneak this in behind our back. At Mount Sinai, we said, all that you say, we will do. Okay? We signed on to this with full knowledge. I, in turn, will do this to you. I will appoint over you a sudden terror, consumption, and fever that will waste away the eyes and cause the soul to pine away. Also, you will sow your seed uselessly, for your enemies will eat it up. I will set my face against you, so that you will be struck down before your enemies, and those who hate you will rule over you, and you will flee when no one is pursuing you. So sickness, harassment, and insecurity. I think that should get our attention, right? We need to be obedient to the covenant. However, if we're not obedient to the covenant, God will turn the screws down a little harder. And in verses 18 through 20, he will curse us with drought and famine. This is the next cycle of curses for disobedience. If after these things you do not obey me, then I will punish you seven times more for your sins. I will also break down your pride of power. I will also make your sky like iron and your earth like bronze. That's a poetic image of drought. Your strength will be spent uselessly, for your land will not yield its produce, and the trees of the land will not yield their fruit. So drought and famine, the additional curses for disobedience. However, if we continue to disobey God, we haven't gotten the message yet. He'll send wild animals among us in verses 21 and 22. If then you act with hostility against me and are unwilling to obey me, I will increase the plague on you seven times according to your sins. It's going to get worse. Pay attention. I will let loose among you the beasts of the field, which will bereave you of your children and destroy your cattle and reduce your number so that your roads lie deserted. So wild animals is the next curse. All of these curses were experienced before and during the Assyrian invasions. Now, page 32 has this timeline. I'm going to build this timeline for you. It's the top of page 32. So from the book of Judges through the Assyrian invasions, our time in the land was characterized by sickness, harassment, insecurity, drought, famine, and wild animals, except for a few exceptions. You know, David, when King David and King Solomon were leading the nation, we prospered. But during the book of Judges, every man did what was right in their own eyes, and we suffered. We suffered. All right, let's move on then. We move on now to verses 23 through 26. If you still don't obey me, you will experience the horrors of siege. Your enemies will besiege your cities, and here's what will happen. And if by these things you are not turned to me, but act with hostility against me, then I will act with hostility against you. And I will strike you seven more times for your sins. I will also bring upon you a sword, which will execute vengeance for the covenant. And when you gather together into your cities, I will send pestilence among you, so that you will be delivered into enemy hands. So the sword, of course, is the enemy armies. They set up siege to the Jewish cities. And when a siege is well underway, disease stalks the city. Pestilence, disease. When I break your staff of bread, 10 women will bake your bread in one oven, and they will bring back your bread in rationed amounts so that you will eat and not be satisfied. So when you're under siege, you run out of your food. Disease stalks the city and famine stalks the city. So the horrors of siege. These horrors were experienced during the Assyrian and Babylonian invasions. So the next step on the timeline. The Assyrian and Babylonian invasions, our cities were besieged. Our cities were besieged. All right, let's take a look at verses 27 through 33. If you still disobey me, you will experience devastation, deportation, dispersion, and cannibalism. Don't you think this would get your attention? You know? God's trying to get our attention. If in spite of this you do not obey me, but act with hostility against me, then I will act with wrathful hostility against you. And I will punish you seven times for your sins. Further, you will eat the flesh of your sons, and the flesh of your daughters you will eat. I then will destroy your high places, and cut down your incense altars, and heap your remains upon the remains of your idols. For my soul shall abhor you. I will lay waste your cities as well, and will make your sanctuaries desolate. And I will not smell your soothing aromas. I will make the land desolate, so that your enemies who settle in it will be appalled over it. You, however, I will scatter among the nations, and I will draw out the sword after you as your land becomes desolate and your cities become waste. So, devastation, deportation, dispersion, and cannibalism. And this horrible curse of cannibalism has come upon the Jewish nation at least twice in our history, and there are records of that. These curses were all experienced during the Babylonian and Roman destructions. Now, Lamentations 4:10 is one of those records of cannibalism. See, Lamentations was written by Jeremiah. Jeremiah lived through the siege of Jerusalem by the Babylonians. He experienced this firsthand. And he writes in Lamentations 4:10, "The hands of compassionate women have boiled their own children. They became their food during the destruction of the daughter of my people. And then Josephus records one instance of this same curse during the Roman destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. In paragraph 3, chapter 6 there, Wars of the Jews, he says, "Now of those that perished by famine in the city, the number was prodigious, and the miseries they underwent were unspeakable." So there's your background. Famine, because of the Roman siege. Paragraph 4. "There was a certain woman that dwelt beyond Jordan. Her name was Mary. She was eminent for her family and her wealth, and had fled away to Jerusalem with the rest of the multitude, and was with them besieged therein at this time. It was now become impossible for her any way to find any more food. She then attended a most unnatural thing, and snatching up her son, who was a child sucking at her breast," here's a child nursing at its mother's breast, "she slew her son and roasted him, and eat the one half of him, and kept the other half by her concealed." And that's where I'll stop, because Josephus goes on with even more stuff. All right.
I lost my appetite.
So the devastation, deportation, dispersion, and cannibalism were experienced during the Babylonian and Roman destructions of the city. All right, at this point in time, we're time to take our break. And we'll pick it up in 15 minutes, so listen for the shofar. And we'll pick it up with the rest of the curses of the covenant. All right, we're underway with verse 34 of Leviticus 26. We've just seen that the curse of devastation, deportation, dispersion, and cannibalism was experienced during the Babylonian and Roman destructions. Now in verses 34 and 35, God describes the state of the land during the dispersion. The land will be resting and desolate. "Then the land will enjoy its Sabbaths all the days of the desolation, while you are in your enemy's land. Then the land will rest and enjoy its Sabbath. All the days of its desolation it will observe the rest, which it did not observe on your Sabbaths while you were living in it." So the land will be resting and desolate. This was experienced after the Babylonian destruction for 70 years and after the Roman destruction for 2,000 years, round number, 1900 to 2,000 years. So here is the next step in the timeline. After the Babylonian and Roman destructions, we experience this curse of the covenant. Now, I hope you're noticing that the arrowheads are getting larger and larger. And the point there is to graphically try to demonstrate that the curses are getting more and more severe. More and more severe. Well, that's one of the last ones, yes. See how it's way up at the end there? So they're getting more and more severe as we continue our history of disobedience. Now, the fact that the land was desolate and resting was brought out very clearly by Mark Twain in his famous book, Innocence Abroad. And now, if you don't know what Innocence Abroad is about, here's a little explanation of the book. The Innocence Abroad, or The New Pilgrim's Progress, kind of a tongue-in-cheek subtitle there, is a travel book by American author Mark Twain, published in 1869, which humorously chronicles what Twain called the Great Pleasure Excursion on board the chartered vessel Quaker City through Europe and the Holy Land with a group of American travelers in 1867. It was the best-selling of Twain's works during his lifetime and one of the best-selling travel books of all time. And if you'd like to read it, it is fun to read. You can get it on Amazon, Innocence Abroad. Especially you guys who have been to Israel, you'll really enjoy it when you get to the point where he finally arrives in the Holy Land. So I read this book on vacation this summer, really enjoyed it. But we have some quotes from Innocence Abroad. Here's what Mark Twain witnessed. He said, "We traversed some miles of desolate country," notice the word he chooses, "whose soil is rich enough, but is given wholly to weeds, a silent, mournful expanse. A desolation is here that not even imagination can grace with the pomp of life and action. We reach Tabor safely. Tabor would be Mount Tabor. We never saw a human being on the whole route. I've added my little note. In other words, the land is deserted. Where are the Palestinians that have been there from time immemorial? Where are the Palestinians who have been there for 5,500 years before Joshua? They're not there, you guys. Yeah, they didn't read the book. We pressed on toward the goal of our crusade, renowned Jerusalem. The further we went, the hotter the sun got, and more rocky and bare and repulsive and dreary the landscape became. There was hardly a tree or a shrub anywhere. Even the olive and the cactus, those fast friends of the worthless soil, had almost deserted the country. No landscape exists that is more tiresome to the eye than that which bounds the approaches to Jerusalem. Jerusalem is mournful, dreary, and lifeless. I would not desire to live here. It is a hopeless, dreary, heartbroken land. And here comes the classic statement that I just love. Palestine sits in sackcloth and ashes. Now, we have photographic evidence of the truth of his statements. I've discovered on the web some black and white photos that were taken in the 1860s. They've been colorized with watercolors. You know, when I was a kid, that was real popular, black and white, and the photographer would colorize it. Well, here's what we found. There's Mount Tabor in the 1860s, desolate and deserted. There's Mount Tabor. Nothing. Just scrub all around it. Here is Mount Carmel. This is where Haifa is located today. Got some cactus there. But look at that. There's some buildings up on the top of Mount Carmel, but that's about it. Here's Jerusalem in the 1860s, quite a bit smaller than it is today. Now, in contrast, here is the Jezreel Valley today, not deserted and desolate anymore, is it? Here's Mount Tabor today. Desolate and deserted? Hardly. Things have changed, haven't they? Here is Mount Carmel. This is Haifa, taken from the top of Mount Carmel. This is Israel's number one port. Again, not desolate or deserted anymore. Here's Jerusalem, thriving modern city. Here are the outskirts of Jerusalem, no longer tiresome to the eye. This is taken from Kiryat Yearim, looking to the west with Jerusalem in the background. And all the trees that have been planted on the Judean hills. Very different from what Mark Twain witnessed. All right, now I mentioned that this was the state of the land for these two experiences. Now let's move on to verses 36 through 39, and God describes the state of the people during these curses, during this dispersion. Fearful, weak, dispersed, and persecuted. As for those of you who may be left, I will also bring weakness into their hearts in the lands of their enemies. And the sound of a driven leaf will chase them. And even when no one is pursuing, they will flee as though from the sword, and they will fall. They will therefore stumble over each other as if running from the sword, although no one is pursuing. And you will have no strength to stand up before your enemies. But you will perish among the nations, and your enemies' land will consume you. So those of you who may be left will rot away because of their iniquity in the lands of your enemies, and also because of the iniquities of their forefathers, they will rot away with them. So the state of the people during this curse, fearful, weak, dispersed, persecuted, this was experienced after the Roman destruction. Now this was not experienced after the Babylonian destruction because we thrived in Babylon. We had it good in Babylon. And in fact, very few Jews wanted to come home from Babylon under Ezra and Nehemiah. That was very different after the Roman destruction. During our 2,000 years in exile, we have experienced being fearful, weak, dispersed, and persecuted.
And that reached a crescendo, Bob, in Nazi.
Yeah, I'll talk about that in just a moment, yeah. Now, Deuteronomy 28, which also covers the curses of the covenant, gives us a parallel account, Deuteronomy 28, 64 through 67. And if you're following along, that again is on The bottom, toward the bottom there, where is it? Leviticus. I guess I don't have it written down there.
Yes, you do.
Do I?
Where?
Okay, I give you the verses there. Okay, here's, we'll read them. Moreover, the Lord will scatter you among all peoples, from one end of the earth to the other end of the earth, worldwide, right? And there you will serve other gods, wood and stone, which you and your fathers have not known. Among these nations you shall find no rest, and there will be no resting place for the sole of your foot. But there the Lord will give you a trembling heart, failing of eyes, and despair of soul. So your life shall hang in doubt before you, and you will be in dread night and day, and shall have no assurance of your life. In the morning you will say, "Would that it were evening." And at evening you will say, "Would that it were morning." Because of the dread of your heart, which you dread, and for the sight of your eyes, which you will see. Now I have a book in my library called The Legacy of Israel by Bevan and Singer. And they describe our experience in Europe during this time. Page 119. Bevan and Singer write, "So for centuries the Jew lived in a constant state of alarm, and often of acute suffering, never knowing but that he might be driven from his home or see it burnt over his head, or be butchered by a mob of ruffians, or sent wandering with wife and children to find shelter, if he could, and if not, to die of starvation." There's a book in Hebrew with the significant title Emek HaBacha, The Valley of Weeping. It gives, in a series of annals, the record of all the massacres known to the writer from the earliest times to his own, and my own footnote there, middle of the 16th century. Every page of that terrible book is, as it were, soaked in blood and tears. And not the least impressive feature in the recital is the way in which the story of horror is told with a dull monotony in which all separate incidents are merged into one long agony of grief. What a concise description of Deuteronomy 28. One long agony of grief. And you can get that book, by the way. The Veil of Tears is still available by Joseph HaCohen. You can get it on Amazon, although it's quite expensive because it's a special translation. But you can get it on Amazon and see exactly what he's talking about. Well, has anything changed? No, here's a pogrom in Poland, 1936. Here's a Jewish home being burnt over the family's heads. Here's a band of ruffians called the Nazis, Warsaw Ghetto, January 1943. "And you shall perish in the land of your enemies," liberation of Dachau, April 29th, 1945. What about today? Anything changed? No. They're still out there. Those who desire the destruction of Israel are still very much around. And we are still experiencing in Israel grief. One long agony of grief. This is the funeral of an Israeli soldier. Everybody in Israel has lost somebody. It's a small country. There's been many wars. Everybody has lost somebody. One long agony of grief. So we've experienced that after the Roman destruction. However, we now come to verse 40. And here everything takes a dramatic turn for the better. In verse 40 through 46, restoration is promised. Verse 40. "If they confess their iniquity and the iniquity of their forefathers in their unfaithfulness which they committed against me, and also in their acting with hostility against me," note, "I was also acting with hostility against them to bring them into the land of their enemies, "or if their uncircumcised heart becomes humbled so that they then make amends for their iniquity, then I will remember" what? "My covenant." There it is. There it is again. Slaps us in the face again. "I will remember my covenant with" who? "My covenant with Jacob, And I will remember also my covenant with Isaac and my covenant with Abraham as well. And I will remember the land. There it is. For the land will be abandoned by them and will make up for its Sabbaths while it is made desolate without them. They, meanwhile, will be making amends for their iniquity because they rejected my ordinances and their soul abhorred my statutes. Yet in spite of this, when they are in the land of their enemies, I will not reject them. Now, we're in the land of our enemies. That means we are living in disobedience. But what does God say? Even in disobedience, I will not reject them. I do not know how a replacement theologian can get around the plain meaning of the text. Israel has not been rejected and replaced by the church, because he states very clearly, even under disobedience, I will not reject them, nor will I so abhor them as to destroy them. See, he's not going to destroy us. That's not how he's going to vindicate himself. Because that would, what? Break my covenant with them. I am the Lord their God. I am not that kind of a person. I keep my promises. I keep my covenants. See what he's saying there in Leviticus 26? I will restore them, but I will remember for them the covenant with their ancestors, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt in the sight of the nations, that I might be their God. I am the Lord. I am a covenant keeper. And then the chapter ends. These are the statutes and ordinances and laws which the Lord established between himself and the sons of Israel through Moses on Mount Sinai. So here God promises a restoration from all these curses of the covenant. It's a restoration from a worldwide dispersion. And here, on our timeline, he jumps to the Messianic kingdom. He jumps to the time of restoration and peace and an end of suffering. So this is also top of page 32 there. But notice there's a gap. There's a gap there. What goes into that gap? One more destruction awaits us. The Antichrist destruction, the tribulation diaspora awaits us. One more awaits us. This is why I'm in Jewish ministries, you guys. 40 years ago, I saw that we were heading for trouble. And that's why I'm doing what I'm doing now. Now, there are other verses that describe this tribulation diaspora, and you can write these down. They're not in your notes. You could add to your notes Matthew 24, verses 15 and 16. These verses speak of that tribulation diaspora. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. So in the middle of the tribulation, the Antichrist will march into the temple and he'll set up this abomination of desolation and begin his tribulation holocaust. Begins in the middle of the tribulation. So there's the warning from Yeshua. Flee, get out of the country. Hurry as fast as you can. Don't even go back for your coat. Go for it. Revelation 12:6 also speaks of this in poetic language. Then the woman, a figure of Israel, what? Fled into the wilderness, where she had a place prepared by God. So there she would be nourished for 1,260 days. That's the second half of the tribulation. But notice, Israel has to flee into the wilderness, out of the land, dispersed. Also Revelation 12:14. But the two wings of the great eagle were given to the woman, and again a picture of Israel. And by the way, the great eagle there is not the U.S. Air Force. This same figure of speech, which is just a figure of speech for rapid flight. That's all it is. The same figure of speech was used during the Exodus. I took you out of Egypt on eagle's wings. The U.S. Air Force was not around in 1446 B.C. All right. But the two wings of the great eagle were given to the woman Israel. So what? So that she could fly into the wilderness, get out of the country, to her place where she was nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. So that is a That is some indicators of our tribulation diaspora, the Antichrist's destruction. Now, our class we're studying falls right between the state of the people and the Antichrist's destruction. There's where our class falls, you guys. This is the time period we're living in. And this is what we're going to be studying, the first regathering, modern Israel. And that, of course, is at the bottom of page 32. So that should give you an idea where we're located on the timeline today. Right there. All righty. That takes care of the blessings and cursings of the covenants. Let's move to point 7, page 33, which is the times of the Gentiles. I need to define this very important prophetic time period. And what is the times of the Gentiles? Well, the best definition is found in Luke 21:24. There, Yeshua says, "They will fall by the edge of the sword and will be led captive into all the nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled." So the best definition of the times of the Gentiles is the long time period under which Jerusalem feels the Gentile domination. Now, on our chart, that would make the times of the Gentiles run from the Babylonian destruction, when the temple was first destroyed, clear to the restoration. From the Babylonian destruction until the restoration, Jerusalem has always felt under the thumb of the Gentiles. Now, this period does not discount temporary Jewish control of the city, like the Maccabean period or the current period where we have partial control of the city. But the city is still under the domination of the Gentiles. And one of the... well, anyway, go ahead. Did you have a question?
So the trampling underfoot of Jerusalem did not end in 67.
No. Jerusalem is still a... Yeah, we'll talk about that in just a moment.
Oh, okay.
Jerusalem is still disputed territory.
It is.
Right. Oh, yeah. Okay.
The generation that sees the budding of the fig tree, does that correlate to what we're talking about here in this time?
No, that's a whole different story. Okay? That's a whole different story. Okay? We'll go on something else here. All right. So the times of the Gentiles will end when the Gentiles no longer trod down the city. I've given you some verses that describe that. So we are living in the times of the Gentiles right now. And in fact, the evidence that Jerusalem is still disputed territory lies in the fact that the Temple Mount is now dominated by the Muslims. This is the Temple Mount. Is a Jewish temple sitting on that platform? No way. To the south, Al-Aqsa Mosque. In the center, the Dome of the Rock. And the Jewish people do not have control over the Temple Mount today or East Jerusalem. So this is very much disputed territory. We only have partial control of Jerusalem today. So there is a spiritual reason why the Palestinians demand that Jerusalem be their capital city. You see, Satan does not want the times of the Gentiles to come to an end. It's not going to end until the Messiah returns. Question?
Yeah, when we were on the Temple Mount, we were told to hide our Bibles because the little place that kind of walk around up there, they saw you praying and stuff like that, they just started to come over.
Exactly. That's the Muslim domination of the Temple Mount. Jews can't pray there. Christians can, because you don't have to pray from a prayer book. I prayed while I was up there. I looked at the Dome of the Rock and I said, "Lord, that's sure a beautiful building. Too bad it's got to go." You know? Many Christians pray up there. But you see, in the Jewish and Muslim mind, prayer is a ritual. Okay, prayer is a ritual, yes.
Now, replacement doctrine that's going on rapidly right now with...
Right. No, the replacement theology really made its first appearance in the Roman Church in the first century.
Okay.
That's why Paul had to write Romans 9, 10, and 11.
Okay.
Romans 9, 10, 11 counters the replacement theology starting to rear its ugly head.
You know,
yeah. So it's been there from the first century. Yeah, yeah. All righty, Let's take a look now on page 33 of the principle of expansion and contraction. Now let me start this topic by asking a question. Have the Jewish people ever possessed all of the promised land? And the answer is, you're correct, you all get an A. No. No. Here is Jewish possession of the land to its greatest extent. Under Solomon's kingdom, you see the pink area was Saul's kingdom, and the orange area was expanded to David's kingdom. And then when Solomon came, he expanded Jewish influence up to the Euphrates River. It really wasn't possession of the land, but basically economic control of the land. Notice that Philistia is not possessed by the Jewish people. Phoenicia is not possessed by the Jewish people. Hamat is not possessed. So this is the greatest extension to date under Solomon. Now, under Solomon, we possessed maybe 75% of the promised land. Now, let's remember back to a couple of principles we learned when we studied the Abrahamic covenant. The first principle is that Jewish ownership of the land is unconditional. We have the title deed based on the Abrahamic covenant. But remember that enjoyment of the land blessing, the land promise, is contingent upon obedience. So that's obedience to the Abrahamic covenant. It's also obedience to the Mosaic covenant. Now this is where the principle of expansion and contraction comes into play. If Israel is obedient, God will increase our possession of the land up until the full borders promised to Abraham. But if we are disobedient, God will reduce the territory that the nation enjoys. And these principles can be found in Deuteronomy 19, verses 8 and 9. This is the principle of expansion. Here the Lord says, "If the Lord your God enlarges your territory, just as he has sworn to your fathers, and gives you all the land which he promised to give your fathers," see, it hasn't been experienced yet, "if you carefully observe all this commandment, which I command you today, to love the Lord your God and to walk in his ways always, then you shall add three more cities for yourself beside these three." He's talking about cities of refuge there. So if you're obedient and your territory expands, you'll have room for three more cities. In fact, you'll need three more cities of refuge. See, that's the point there. Obedience brings expansion of the borders until the full promised amount. Make sense? All right, now the principle of contraction. This is seen in 2 Kings 10, 31 and 32 with evil King Jehu. But Jehu was not careful to walk in the law of the Lord, the God of Israel, with all his heart. He did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, which he made Israel sin. The consequence? In those days, the Lord began to cut off portions from Israel, and Hazael defeated them throughout the territory of Israel. So if we're disobedient, we suffer harassment from our enemies, and the land shrinks. Our blessing shrinks. Make sense? Okay. Keep that in mind. Keep that in mind. Now, the following charts on page 34 shows you how this principle of expansion and contraction have worked out over the history of Israel. So we're going to start with the ancient possession of the land, and we're going to build this graph. Okay? First time period, Abraham. Abraham possessed virtually none of the promised land. He had to buy his burial plot at Hebron. So very little of the land was possessed under Abraham. But when we came into the land in the book of Judges, we began to conquer the land. And we conquered, say, up to maybe 20% of it. This is just a guess on my part as I've looked at maps. Under the United Kingdom, under David and Solomon, the land possession grew to maybe 70%, as I showed you on that map. Here's another map. Solomon's kingdom, all the way up to the Euphrates River. The green being Solomon's kingdom at the beginning of his reign, the gray, the expansion of his kingdom. So that's the largest Jewish possession of the land to date under the United Kingdom. Then the kingdom divided over the issue of taxes, and we began to get more and more disobedient, and God began to chop away at the kingdom. With the Assyrian conquest, the northern kingdom was gone. The northern 10 tribes were gone, and we were down to possessing maybe 30% of the land under Judea. With the Babylonian exile, Judea was conquered, and again, we were out of the land. 99% of us gone. But we returned after 70 years, and we began to possess more and more of the land. Under the Hellenistic period, we possessed, when we threw the Greeks out, we were possessing maybe 40% of the land, but in came the Romans, and our possession was reduced to maybe 20%, and then with the first Jewish revolt and the first worldwide dispersion, we're down to basically possessing zero again, kicked out of the land. Okay? Now let's take a look at modern possession of the land. What's going on in our modern day? Well, we start with that first worldwide dispersion under Rome, where we virtually own none of the land. And then the first worldwide regathering will begin, 1839 to 1948. We begin to buy back the territory. We begin to plant cities and kibbutzim and moshavim and all that. And we gain more and more land. With the War of Independence, we're back to owning maybe 30% of the land in 1948. With the Six-Day War, we conquer the West Bank. And now we're owning approximately 40% of the land, although we didn't annex it at this time. With the Yom Kippur War, we maintained our possession of the land at about 40%. With the Lebanon War, remained static. With the Gulf War, it remained static. But now the peace process has begun. And we're losing Israel piece by piece. And we've lost Gaza. You know, we pulled out of Gaza. Our territory has reduced. Our blessings, the blessings of the land, have been reduced. We're still under curses of the covenant, guys. We're still a disobedient people. Now, the near future, where will it go? Who knows? Will we annex the West Bank and get back to 40%? Or will we lose the West Bank? What's going to happen? We'll have to see. We'll have to see. We don't know where it will go. But we do know that when the second worldwide dispersion comes in the middle of the tribulation, we will be kicked out of the land again. But there's hope. There's hope. What happens with the second coming of Yeshua? The second worldwide regathering, and finally we will own and possess the full boundaries of the promised land. That's how it's going to work out. We know the end of the story. Okay? All righty. Our class, again, will start with the first worldwide regathering, 1839 to 1947, with Zionism, and then we'll march through those wars and a lot more as we continue through our class. We'll look at the War of Independence, the Six-Day War, Yom Kippur War, all the way down to the peace process and what's going on today. So that's where our class is going to go. All righty, let's call it a night, and let me pray, and we'll pick it up on with some chronology next week. On page 35. All right, let's pray. Father, again, I am just so encouraged by the fact that you keep your promises, that even in disobedience, you will not reject Israel. And that tells us that living under the new covenant, when we make our mistakes and when we're disobedient, we have eternal security. You will not reject us either. Because we live under the new covenant today. Because you are the Lord. You are the covenant-keeping God of the universe. And we are grateful for that. But Lord, it goes both ways. Help us to remember, when we disobey, you will discipline us. And when we obey, you will bless us. It goes both ways. Because you're holy and righteous. And you make sure justice is done. So, Lord, help us to keep that very much in view as we walk through this world each day, and help us share that with those around us. We ask this in Yeshua's name. Amen. See you next week.